for Linda. And yeah, Eric's attitude was very much like, it would be very good for you to talk about this. The stress will make you think hard. And so it's, he's right, it's good advice. I thought very hard last week about how to present this story. So yeah, so at this stage, there aren't too many new results, but I think it's a very interesting story, so I think it'd be fun to show you how it all works. So yeah, so basically it's a very simple talk, just three parts. I'd like to start by reviewing quite an old idea by Ted Jacobson about how to view the Einstein equation as an equation of state. So just Einstein gravity, but with a twist. And what I'm interested in doing, the calculation I want to do, is to see how to extend this set of ideas to a more general theory of gravity. So, you know, we think of gravity as an effective field theory. You've got the Riemann, you know, you've got the Einstein-Hilbert term, plus you've got a whole series of higher derivative operators appearing. You know, I'd like to understand how you can view gravity in the general sense as an equation of state. And to do this, the sort of tool I'm going to be trying to use is the Ward entropy for black holes, except I'm going to be pulling it away from black holes to a special local form that I'm going to talk about. So, great. So let's start by thinking about black holes, all right? So the usual logic is you take the Einstein equations, you go away, you derive the first law of black hole mechanics. So this is this strange, mysterious global statement. It's connecting the behavior of fields at infinity with the behavior of fields at the event horizon. It's a very non-trivial statement here. And, you know, by analogy, you identify the entropy as being the area of the black hole and the temperature as the surface gravity. And yes, if you then go away and add quantum field theory on this curved spacetime, then Hawking radiation comes out and this analogy becomes an identity, if you like. We can actually, you know, the entropy physically is the area of the black hole. So the trouble with the usual logic, with the usual story, it's quite a mysterious statement. I mean, how does classical general relativity know that the area of the black hole is going to turn out to be a form of entropy? It's almost like classical general relativity knows about Hawking radiation, even though it's just a classical theory. It's kind of mysterious. You've just got this hyperbolic second-order partial differential equation, yet it's got this predisposition to thermodynamic behavior. Where did that come from? So Jacobson's idea is to invert the logic. Let's stand this story on its head. And it's slightly deeper than it might sound at first sight. So let's start the other way around. Let's start with thermodynamics. So we're going to start with saying, let's assume the proportionality between entropy and horizon area. And we're going to take the first law of thermodynamics. And he's got a way of showing how the Einstein equation pops out. And with this logic, you view the Einstein equation as an equation of state. So let me just remind everyone of your undergraduate thermodynamics. So what is an equation of state? So the idea is, let's say you know the entropy as a function of the other extensive variables in the system, so the energy and the volume, for example. So you've got the chain rule. And also you've got the first law of thermodynamics. So the point is, if you combine the two, you obtain just a definition of temperature and the equation of state. So the way to think about an equation of state is it's a consistency relation that, you know, you want the first law of thermodynamics and your definition of entropy. If you know the functional form of the entropy and you know the first law, the equation of state is a consistency relation making the two consistent. And so,
I mean, just as the first one, the definition.
I suppose the point is pressure is a thermodynamic observable you can measure independent of knowing the equation of state. You know, to specify an equation of state, you have to know the entropy as a function of the energy and volume. Actually, pressure is a variable in its own right. It's a variable appearing in the first law of thermodynamics.
Well, maybe I got it wrong. Are you calling, if I give you an expression for the entropy as a function of the energy and the volume,
yeah,
I can call that as an equation of state?
No. You have a first law. You have two ingredients. There's only, you have to have the entropy as a function. You have to know the functional form of the entropy, and you have to impose the first law. And the two together, you find the equation of state.
But I was thinking this way. I mean, a pressure is a thing in, you know, in an ensemble. I mean, when you view it in statistical mechanics, right?
That's
S as a function of E and V is a statement in a microcanonical ensemble.
Exactly.
Right?
So basically, it's a statistical mechanical input to know S as a function of V. So yeah, that's kind of the key idea. You know, it's think of an ideal gas, right? So in this case,
if it's a Deleuze ideal gas, you know the entropy is basically, you know, it's the logarithm of the number of states, so it's basically the logarithm of the volume of the gas. Mm-hmm. So, and there could be some arbitrary function of energy. So basically, dSdV comes out as 1 over V, so that gives you PV as proportional to temperature, which is the ideal gas for. Okay, so that's the way it works. So in our case, we're going to look at Einstein's equations. So our thermodynamics is we're going to assume entropy and area proportional. That's our specification of the entropy. And the first law is going to get imposed by imposing the Bianchi identities and the Clausius relation, delta Q is T delta S, which applies, if you're going from state A to state B via some reversible path where the system is in equilibrium all the way along the path. So,
do you have a particular ensemble in mind?
So I'm going to come on the next slide on as to how we define the system and how we define what we mean by local equilibrium and how we define all these quantities like heat flux and entropy. So perhaps perhaps just let me get on to the next thing.
Okay.
I'm not doing statistical mechanics, I'm just going to do classical thermodynamics.
Okay, so one more question then. Is this very general, or do you have some kind of boundary conditions in mind, or are we thinking about asymptotic flat space-time?
This is just general, boundary conditions. Basically, we're going to do the analysis locally about each point in space. So, what we're basically going to take any point in space and look at your past horizon, and the idea is that the past space-time outside your past horizon, that's going to be our system. And, you know, we're going to exchange energy with that system, and it's got a temperature, and it's got an entropy, which is basically going to be the area of the past horizon. So I'll show you on the next slide how to formulate this a little more precisely. So if you like, the logic is that... No, I'll come back to this. Okay, so there's four things we need to specify, right, to get this set up. So first of all, we need to specify what's the system, what do we mean by thermodynamic equilibrium. And we also need to specify the temperature, what we mean by heat flux, and what we mean by the change in entropy. Okay, so we're going to start with these sort of Bousseau-esque constructions. So let's just take space-time is locally flat about any point. Let's take some space-like two surface going through that point, and let's look at the path-directed null-normal congruence to this two surface to one side. So we can always choose this space-like two surface. So this path-directed null-normal congruence, vanishing expansion shear, so expansion of theta shear sigma at this two surface. So the idea is that the thermodynamic system is a part of space-time outside your past horizon, and we'd like this system to be instantaneously in equilibrium at the origin. And so what that means is that the horizon can't be changing at the origin. So basically the expansion vanishes and the shear vanishes. So that's going to be our definition of what it means to be in equilibrium. And the next thing we need to specify is how does the temperature, you know, what's the temperature of the system? So we're going to piggyback on the idea of this non-normal congruence. Ah. So basically, you know, just look at all the light sheets coming into this point. Yeah, we just want to have no expansion. And the point is, I can always choose the surface so as to make that true. You know, if the surface were curved, then you'd have expansion.
Is it flat there?
Yes, exactly.
Right. So you're assuming the existence of the horizon?
No. This is not a global event horizon. This is just a local causal horizon of any particular point.
Okay.
You know, draw a little two surface.
It's part of the past.
Yeah, it's a past horizon. It's past causal horizon.
Okay.
Yeah, that's important. Yeah, exactly. So with black holes, you're talking about event horizons in global states. Here we're talking about local, you know, is this like Rindler horizon at the point? Okay, so temperature. So the idea is we're going to piggyback on usual Unruh calculations. So we're going to find the temperature of your horizon. So you have to imagine a uniformly accelerated observer who's hovering just inside the horizon. So the temperature is going to be the Unruh temperature seen by this accelerated observer, and we're also going to use this same accelerated observer to find the heat flux. So this uniformly accelerated observer follows the orbit of the Killing field, you know, basically generating boosts orthogonal to the surface, and the Killing field also vanishes at the surface. Just think of the usual boost vector, boost Killing field in Minkowski's space, that means x d by dt and t d by dx, so it vanishes at the origin, x and t equal 0. So in a general space-time, you don't have Killing vector fields. But the point is, you can solve, let's start at one particular point, and we're going to work in like Riemann normal coordinates, and we're going to try and solve Killing's equation outward from that point. So the point is you can always solve the Killing equation up to order x cubed about any point.
So it's just an approximate Killing boost, it's an approximate Killing vector field about any point.
This is all Jacobson, this is a review of Jacobson's argument, I should say, this is not my work.
Isn't it built in, the fact that you have to have some Killing vectors?
So it's only locally a Killing vector up to order x cubed about any point in Riemann normal coordinates. So you just need to solve the Killing equation order by order. Mm-hmm. And you can see it works up to x cubed because the Christoffel symbol is of order x, and the Killing vector vanishes at the origin, so the Killing vector has to be also of order x. So you can't solve Killing's equation at order x squared, and because it's d of chi in Killing's equation, that means you can solve chi up to order x cubed. So this is still completely general. So ordinary radiation says that the temperature seen by this accelerated observer is just proportional to the acceleration, and if we normalize the Killing orbit on which our observer is moving, if we normalize the Killing vector to unity on this orbit, then the acceleration is just the surface gravity of the Killing horizon. And the sort of idea is that if we make this acceleration tend to infinity, you can see that the observer's world line gets closer and closer and eventually coincides with the horizon. So in this limit, the temperature is going to diverge, but the point is heat flux is also going to diverge, and the ratio of delta Q over T is going to be finite. And that's what we need in Clausius' situation.
So you can get a family of those. But for that whole family, that ratio would be the same?
Yes, that's right. So basically, yeah, the normalization can get drop out, so it doesn't really matter yet.
So what's delta Q here?
Delta Q is just to be defined now. So delta Q is the heat flux flowing across a segment of the horizon, the past horizon. So the idea here is that, so we basically just use the fact that we've got a Killing vector now, this boost Killing field. So the point is you can define a conserved boost energy current. So just contract the stress energy tensor with a Killing vector. So this is conserved current by Killing's equation. You can see the stress tensor is symmetric. Killing's equation tells you that the grad chi is anti-symmetric, so this current is conserved. So let's just integrate this conserved current across the segment of the horizon, that's d sigma b. And we obtain this this is the heat flux across the horizon, across the segment of the horizon. So the horizon surface element d sigma b, kb is the affine tangent vector along the horizon, and lambda is an affine parameter running along the horizon, and it's a cross-sectional area of the horizon. So you remember the first diagram had this space like two surface elements, and now we're going to just shrunk that down to a point. So the blue line is really a congruence case. So the cross-sectional area is congruence. And the other thing is that, k is the affine tangent vector, but the Killing vector on the horizon, obeys the usual relation, which is a non-affinely parameterized geodesic equation. It's chi A, grad A, chi B is equal to surface gravity, chi B. So the connection between the Killing vector on the horizon and the affine tangent vector is just you've got to go from a non-affinely parameterized geodesic to an affinely parameterized geodesic. So that's where this relation here comes from. So let's just stick those ingredients together, and we've got the heat flux across the segment of the horizon. And you can check now that it's independent of the surface gravity. You can see the kappa drops out. The Killing vector enters linearly in the definition of heat flux and the definition of temperature. So dq over t is independent. Okay, so the final ingredient we need is the entropy change along the segment of the horizon. So remember, our import was that the entropy was going to be proportional to the area of the horizon. That's the area of this, that's a cross-sectional area of this geodesic, of this congruence of null geodesic. So, the expansion is just a fractional change in area per unit affine distance along the congruence. That's this here, right? So delta S is just given by the integral of the expansion times the lambda times the cross-sectional area of the congruence. And then we just use Ray Chowdhury's equation. This has nothing to do with Einstein's equation. This is just purely a geometrical relation. So because we chose, so this is where the definition of local equilibrium came in, right?
because we chose theta and sigma, the expansion shear to vanish at p, that means there must be at least of order lambda. And so theta squared, sigma squared of order lambda squared, so we neglect them, and we can just integrate Reijard-Urey's equation trivially up to the order we need, which says that the expansion is just the Riemann tensor times the two affine tangent vectors. So, yep, so that gives us delta S. Okay, so we've got our four ingredients. We've got what we mean by thermodynamic equilibrium. We've got the heat flux and the temperature from this Rindler observer, and we've got the entropy change, which is the change of area of this congruence. So now we just assemble everything all together.
So let's impose Clausius relation, and let's link these two things together.
So let's think about what this means. Okay, this is actually really quite neat. So the point is, so delta S is the focusing, it's the change in area of this congruence of geodesics generating horizon. And delta Q is related to the matter flux across the horizon. So basically, the physical import of this Clausius relation is that matter flux across the horizon causes a focusing of geodesics. So, yeah, so basically this is then almost enough to give us the answer. So I've just related delta S to delta Q over T. And the point is, this has to hold, you know, for all k along the congruence, then about any point in space, this has to hold as well. So basically, this is holding for all null k. So you've got the second line. And the point is, phi, you know, because k is null, if you contract this line with, you know, kk, obviously that phi term drops out. So phi is just this arbitrary term coming in. But to fix phi, we impose the Bianchi identities. So remember, this is like imposing energy conservation. This is like the first law of thermodynamics here. So as we just take the Bianchi identities, and that allows you to fix phi, the nice thing is that you've got this undetermined constant coming in, which is a cosmological constant. So it remains enigmatic as ever. You know, the cosmological constant just pops out of this analysis, so we have no more understanding of where it comes from than we ever did. But anyway, yep, you recover Einstein's equations. So now we see it as an equation of state. And the nice thing also is that, you know, if you just compare the coefficient of the stress tensor to 8 pi g Newton, then you can actually pick off alpha, which was the proportionality constant between entropy and area. It just comes out to be one over the Planck length squared. So that's also nice. That's like the Beckett-Planck-Hawking entropy. So what I'd like to understand is how much of this was just a fluke, a lucky accident. You know, maybe this just worked because of the special properties of Beckenstein-Hawking, you know, just Einstein gravity. Would this work for any generic theory of gravity? You know, why should you believe this unless it's something that's generally true for any sort of theory of gravity you could write down? So that's the sort of question I want to answer. So yes.
I mean, usually one runs, as you said, one runs an argument.
Yeah.
Proves the second law by using Reijard-Urey equation and stuff like that. But in that entire derivation, one never determines the coefficient of entropy to area. I guess because one doesn't use the coefficient of the temperature to...
So the usual picture is you take Reijard-Urey's equation and plug in the Einstein equations to replace the Ricci tensor with the stress tensor. That's how matter causes focusing.
Right.
So here it's a bit cheeky. We're kind of doing the other way around.
Now, I was just wondering how you got the coefficient. I guess that's linked to the fact that you took the temperature to be precisely the unruh temperature.
That's correct. The 2 pi was that's there. Right. That's correct. Yeah. So the way this works is basically the thermodynamics of the Minkowski vacuum is what's leading to black hole thermodynamics in this derivation. So let's think about so this story is about 10 years old. What I just reviewed was this Ted Jacobson paper from 1995. So after nearly 10 years, they returned to pick up the gauntlet. This is papers like last year. So the idea is, you know, let's try and generalize this story for any sort of general theory of gravity.
Can I ask a follow-up to this question? Is it fair to say then that if I demand that the temperature is what I think it should be, then I get the correct proportionality between entropy and area?
Yeah. Okay, so let's try and do this story more general. Let's allow entropy to be some kind of general function of geometrical quantities, not just the area of the last horizon. So let's think about trying to do this as a Taylor expansion. So our affine parameter is just between 0 at our surface and it's negative along the path. So yeah, let's just do a Taylor expansion about lambda equals 0 and try and match up, you know, the dq and the ds order by order with lambda And you know, of course, at lab cubed order, the killing field, you can't solve Killing's equation. So basically, you know, there's only lab squared order we need to worry about. So, okay, so before we had that expression for delta q, so you can see that delta q d lambda vanishes, and it's only at lambda squared order that this thing is non-zero. So now let's think about some general entropy density, which I'm going to call little s, at great risk of confusion with big S, which is the total entropy. So let's differentiate the total entropy with respect to lambda. And the first thing that pops out is that you've got the expansion of the congruence, that's this theta, is non-zero. In general, it's going to be non-zero at lambda equals zero. So before Einstein gravity, you know, this entropy, little s is the entropy density, it's the entropy per unit area. So before that was a constant, so dS d lambda was zero. So before the expansion vanished about the two surface we chose to begin with, but in general, that's going to be non-zero. So this is kind of interesting. You might think at first that this meant that we weren't in equilibrium at the point, but we are in equilibrium because the entropy is stationary with respect to lambda. So the way to think about this is it's much better to use killing time. So killing time is related to affine time, you know, just by this exponential here. So let's look at the expansion with respect to the affine parameter, with respect to the killing parameter rather than the affine parameter. That's the theta twiddle. So the point is, so as lambda goes to zero, the killing parameter goes to minus infinity. So for the Einstein gravity case, the expansion vanished at lambda equals zero. So that means the expansion was of order lambda. So the expansion with respect to killing parameter goes as e to the minus 2 nu, killing parameter. Whereas in the general case, theta is going to be non-zero. And so theta twiddle goes as e to the minus nu. So the point is, in both cases, you've got this exponential relaxation towards equilibrium. It's just in the Einstein case, it goes twice as fast as in the general case. So in Einstein's gravity, you know, we just have equilibrium thermodynamics. But the idea is, in general, we ought to be expecting there to be, you know, the entropy change is going to be greater than that you get just for a reversible process. So in general, we could add some extra internal entropy production term. So I guess the way I like to think about this is that you know, it probably would be there for Einstein too, but actually it's pushed up to one higher order, and you don't see it because the killing vector is only, you know, only exists up to order lambda cubed. So I think basically that's my sort of intuition about this point. I'm going to push on. Yeah.
Because we know, the thing is that if you're in a synthetically flat space-time, the canonical ensemble is basically not stable, right? Unless you put your black hole in a box. And so what do you mean exactly by near equilibrium then? So you're returning...
We're very different to black hole case, because this is all local analysis about, you know, each point in space-time, where we're just looking at the local, we're looking at the past rise of each point in space.
But at some point, the fact that you've got, whether your particles can fly off to infinity and never come back and...
I haven't even got particles, of course. I'm just...
Also, that's more influx. Like a question of
influx.
Every assumption that breaks down long before you can...
I mean, you can easily just not talk about... If you're talking about heat flux, the fact that in a synthetically flat space, you've got enough space that your particles that are created carrying this heat can go off to infinity. I mean, tells you something about the stability of the ensemble that you're talking about. I just don't see just how, like, some information that you need in order to define your ensemble and depends on the asymptopia of the space-time goes into this analysis. I mean, that's the only thing.
Asymptotic relations I haven't thought about. Yeah. It's not in here, then either. That's the push off now.
Right. Okay, so the point was, yeah, we're trying to look at the general case, and we're treating things as a Taylor expansion about this surface we began to begin with. So basically, the point was that in general, you know, in both cases, you're exponentially relaxing towards equilibrium, but in the general case, the relaxation is slower. So the point is, you might expect some sort of internal entropy production term. And so Jacobson and company now looked at a special case of, you know, where your Lagrangian is just a general polynomial in the Ricci scalar. And in this special case, they're able to show that So I work out d squared, entropy, d lambda squared, and basically this dangerous term in red. And this, in this special case of f of r gravity, then they're able to show that this little term in red basically corresponds to an internal entropy production term. You can think of it as like a bulk viscosity, the entropy production due to bulk viscosity, the expansion squared. You know, if you go away and work away at your hydrodynamics, there's like a TdS d lambda, and the bulk viscosity gives you an expansion squared term. So that's where the identification of this term came from. But the point is that if you take this term out, we treat it as an internal entropy production term, then the remainder, we're able to impose the Bianchi identity successfully and recover the correct equations of motion. So my point about all this is I'm just trying to warn you of this non-equilibrium feature that arises in the general case. But I'd like to stress that this paper from last year only does a special case of f of r gravity, and I don't think their method would work in a general case. And this is something that I want to crack. So we need to know the connection between we want to get the equations of motion out from this entropy density. So we need to know the connection between the Lagrangian and the entropy density. So this is where the idea of Wald entropy is going to come in, And the other thing is, it's a much deeper conceptual picture of what entropy really is for the black hole case. And I think this is going to help us, because the difficult step is basically imposing the Bianchi identities in general. And, Wald entropy is going to give us a much more powerful idea of what's going on. So I'd like to just skip very quickly to sort of explain. I'm just going to give a lightning review of Wald entropy. Yes, lightning.
So the point is we've got a stationary black hole
with a bifurcate killing horizon. So the point is the horizon's, horizon's a null surface, there's a killing vector field, it also goes null along this surface. Bifurcate means that the killing vector vanishes along at a particular point where the past and future might intersect. So we've got some general gravitational Lagrangian. So the key point of Wald's analysis is that you can think of black hole entropy as a Noether charge associated with this horizon killing field. And moreover, we can write it as a local geometrical quantity that we can integrate across the horizon. So there's three steps to his analysis. It's very beautiful. This is fantastic stuff. So the point is, your theory is invariant under general diffeomorphisms. We can write down a conserved current stemming from this diffeomorphism invariance, and we can integrate this conserved current across some slice to get a conserved charge, to get a surface charge, if you like. And the point is that, the point is a Noether charge is connected with a global symmetry. So in a special case where this general diffeomorphism is a killing vector generating an isometry of the metric, in this special case, this surface charge is the usual Noether charge. The second point of the analysis, this is really the magic step, is to connect, they look at the variation of this conserved current, and you can construct a sort of symplectic current density out of this. And if you integrate this up across Cauchy surface, you get the variation of the Hamiltonian. And if your variation corresponds to the horizon killing field, basically the variation of the Hamiltonian vanishes, and you obtain what you need, which is an expression connecting surface integral across infinity to a surface integral across a bifurcation surface. And the surface integral across infinity is your change in energy and angular momentum of the black hole, and the integral across the bifurcation surface of the black hole, this is going to be the entropy of the black hole. So very quickly, that's how it works. So the final step is to eliminate the dependence of the killing vector field. We just want a local geometrical expression for the entropy of the black hole. So there's three tricks we use to do that. First is the usual killing identity here. So this allows us to relate any number of grads acting on the killing vector to just the killing vector and its curl. Basically, it's first driven. You just act with this repeatedly. And the second point is that the killing vector vanishes on the bifurcation surface. So basically, our expression is only going to depend on the curl of the killing vector. And there's this magic identity that comes from Frobenius's theorem. You have to use this kind of less well-known dual version of Frobenius's theorem to establish that the curl of the killing vector on the bifurcation surface is the surface gravity times the binormal. I'm not going to try and explain that in 30 seconds. But I'm very happy to do so afterwards. So the binormal, basically, the point is you've got this bifurcation surface, which is a two surface. Did I say I was not going to explain this? Okay, basically, there's two null directions orthogonal to the bifurcation surface, and the exterior product of those two null vectors gives you the binormal. So after a lot of work, you get this entropy, you get this expression for the black hole entropy. Actually, this one, this was actually first worked out by Kang Myers and Jacobson, this form I'm giving here. So how do I apply this technology to my case, the Jacobson argument, where you've got this local horizon? Just 2 points I want to make. First is that in both cases, you've got to bifurcate killing horizon. You know, this is crucial because, you know, it's this bifurcation surface that allows us to use those identities on the killing vector field to eliminate the curl of the killing vector. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of identities. Basically, this is work I'm doing. I'm very nearly there. And the idea, so basically, the difficult step I'm stuck on is trying to improve the Bianchi identities, but I've only been working on this for a week, so I reckon, give me another week to feed me lots of coffee and I should be there. So I'm going to stop there. So the idea, just to summarize, the idea is I'm going to start with the walled entropy density, which I've got in terms of the derivative of the Lagrangian selective Riemann tensor, and I'm going to impose the thermodynamic identity, the first law, which is basically the Bianchi identity, and the Clausius relation, possibly allowing for internal entropy production. And I'm going to get out the equations of state. I'm going to get out the gravitational field equations with interpretation as an equation of state. So thank you. I'll stop there.
The Clausius relation, we're really just assuming that in the analysis here. We don't really have an argument for why it should be the case, right?
It's very deep. This is just basic thermodynamics, isn't it? The point is that you're going to go from one state to another state. The entropy is a state function. Entropy is those two states. Whereas the heat change can go from one state to the other. This could be anything in principle. So we want to make this heat change to be a state function. So the way we do that is we specify you go from A to B via a reversible path where the system is in equilibrium at that point. So if we've got the first law, which is energy conservation, you've got dq, and you want to replace that with Ts. So that's where Clausius is related.
I know where it comes into the analysis. Yeah. I'm just asking you or pointing out, it seems like this is just
it's an assumption.
It's just an assumption.
Remember, there were two assumptions. One was the form of the entropy, the other was Clausius relation, basically the first law of thermodynamics. And those two together gave us the equation of state.
So they're both why there should be equilibrium at all.
No. So this is kind of the point. What's the significance of this? In general, you know, the Einstein equation only holds under equilibrium conditions. So you wouldn't expect to quantize an equation of state. This perspective suggests you might want to quantize the Einstein equation. So you quantize the metric. It made no more sense in quantizing the equation of state.
That would be more of this step. That's what it was going to be.
I hate to cut this discussion off, but we'll be bothered by music if we don't hurry on. Sorry. Neil Barnaby.